members of the Commonwealth of California, guests, I am here now to testify that I think the program committee is all right. We are today honored by an old friend. His Commonwealth Club address in December last ran through three editions, totaling 10,000 copies, as an evidence of the demand on the part of the club members and others for a reprint of that address. The Colonel is a former member of the United States government intelligence staff in the Far East. He was the first American officer since the time of General Pershing to be attached to the Japanese Army as an observer. And in fact, at the time he volunteered to serve on the staff of General MacArthur in 41, he was in the East on such a mission representing the commanding general. He was in, as I say, special military intelligence mission in the Far East in 1941. Out of Corregidor by order, he proceeded by submarine. He was thereafter assigned to lecture on military intelligence, to lecture the United States troops on Japanese tactics. He has been present at combat operations in Normandy, Brittany, and France. This hard-hitting soldier is one who showed the champion Japanese jiu-jitsu performer that he was better than the Japanese. But the colonel is both a hard-hitting soldier and a gentleman, not like some of our warriors who feel that they must continue to be tough all their lives. Our speaker today will address you on the job ahead with Japan, and in that he will bring his momentous analysis of 6 months ago up to date. It is a pleasure to present to you Colonel Warren I. Clear.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, I'm very proud and complimented to be so cordially welcomed as an old friend. But I believe that the membership of this distinguished forum should indignantly do something about having me imposed on them twice in 6 months. Even in time of war, an organization is not supposed to be subjected to an ordeal like that. However, it constitutes some kind of a record in my lifetime for me. And that word record reminds me of an incident back in France last fall. An Air Corps grease monkey or mechanic had gotten tired of greasing up planes for other fellas to fly. And on this particular day that we arrived at the field, he decided to take off himself. And in the space of about 20 seconds, he took down a lot of telephone wires, took the corner out of the control building, and nosedived into a clump of pines. And as he was climbing down one of the pine trees, there was a tough old sergeant down close by, and the embarrassed grease monkey looked down and said, "Well, Sarge, I guess I made some kind of a record." And the sergeant's answer was a typical regular army answer. He said, "Yeah, you're the first condemned monkey I ever saw climb down a tree without first climbing up it. My remarks today, I hope, will render a service, and they're particularly pointed to those of you who mold public opinion through the War Advertising Council and other media. The dawn of peace in Europe has long shadows, like any other daybreak. And like all humans, we face the light with our backs squarely to the west, where the night still reigns. Germany is finished, but Japan is unconquered. One thought which has occupied me for many years and still remains with me is the supreme difficulty of trying to explain the Far East to the American public, of trying to lay open the devious, involuted mind of the Oriental to the busy, preoccupied thinking of the Occidental. In this war, you makers of public opinion are the movers and the shakers of American understanding. To you has been given the talent to portray for the American public the broad aspects and the smaller vignette of their interests in this, their war. You are the heralds of this age and the interpreters of this vast struggle. And I am including every man in this room in that definition. In your capacities as catalysts of public opinion, I propose to speak to you of the human equation in the war in the Far East. I think that I can relate in part what the decisive action by the United States in this war will mean to the common man here and in the Orient. The immortal lines of Kipling, that never the twain shall meet, does not apply in a war. If you ask me today what victory will produce for us in the Far East, I would be inclined to ask you what kind of a victory you mean. Some victories are as hollow as the eyes of dead men. Now that the issue is joined in the Far East, only one result is of any use whatsoever to the common man of America, and that is a complete, overwhelming, paralyzing, cataclysmic victory, which will be recounted in Oriental song and saga for the next 1,000 years. To speak of the Orient is to include the vast, restless millions, the myriad tongues, the fatalistic philosophies and religions, the eternal struggles for the barest necessities, which are congenital to Mother Asia and the islands of the tropic seas. The issue I have mentioned is not one of a knightly and chivalrous passage at arms, but one of dramatic victory so complete and so devastating that there will be no room for any Oriental mind to hold the thought that Japan has lost the war but kept her face. Beyond Okinawa, littered with the bodies of the most implacable and barbarous foe in our history, lie the populous distances of Asia, where ancient peoples brood over the present dark fates and the inscrutable future. The fate of Asia is at stake today, and our fate along with it. Our national prestige is riding with our tanks and planes in Asia. How we fight, what we do, is being scrutinized by the billion people of Asia. Now, the wily Japanese did not start this war merely to acquire islands and raw materials. The great imponderable prestige was involved in every plan and every devilish act. As early as 1934, you will remember, they were stripping American and British men and women who had to pass through their barricades in Tientsin. While they stood naked for search, the Japanese soldiery slapped their faces, not only to be cruel, but because they knew that the whole Orient was looking on. And a slap in the face is an act of contempt and humiliation. They paraded our men captured at Bataan and Corregidor in nudity and semi-nudity before the eyes of thousands of Orientals. Amazed Orientals, amazed that the Occidental had succumbed to Oriental power. As those of you who have been in the Far East know only too well, in the Orient, prestige rests on force, and it always will. All this, and the subsequent demeaning of the Occidental, was a calculated technique to impress the billion people of Asia, so that someday, under Japanese leadership, their docile hordes might be led out of their own continent to spill over the rest of the world. A Hitler in Asia could raise an army of 100 million men. 100 years from now, he could raise an army twice that size. And the Japanese plan in centuries, not in decades. Now, the Herrenvorg idea of the German is new to Europe, but old to Asia. The Japanese have had it all the days of their national life. As you know, they attribute to their emperor divinity, to their people a descent from the sun. They were prepared to use every method, modern and ancient, spiritual and material, to line up the millions to sweep the earth clear. No sacrifice of this Japanese generation is too heavy or of the generations unborn. Their plan was simple and well laid. It was to use their own and all the peoples of Asia to fulfill their ends. And that end was and is to crush Western civilization as we know it, all decency and Christianity, all our works and accomplishments. Now in 1944, the Japanese called a convocation of representatives of every nation, colony, and tribe in the Far East. It was a meeting of Oriental minds, and they came over mountains and deserts and across the seas. The setting was Singapore, the scene of the British Empire's worst defeat. My representative recently talked with two of the Philippine delegation, Lingayo and Batista, at Manila. Those delegates, and there were several thousands of them, heard much propaganda about the Great Eastern Prosperity Sphere, but they were told principally of the Japanese victories, of Japanese military skill, and of the devastating effect of those victories. The Japanese showed them pictures of Pearl Harbor. They dramatized all their accomplishments. They left the impression that time and human life mean nothing. They had absorbed the Western techniques and usage of the weapons of war. They had beaten the Western powers with their own weapons. And come what might, they would repeat again and again. Now the result of this propaganda has been to inculcate in the lowliest Oriental a vast respect for Japanese arms and powers, a respect which will reach far beyond this war unless our victory is so cataclysmic that Asia will be shocked into recognizing it. They hate Japan in many parts of Asia, but they respect her everywhere. She has been known as a fierce warrior power for 2,000 years, and we must destroy her prestige as well as her army. How can this be done, you may well ask, and how can you help? You, in fact, are like the conductors of great symphonies who can raise or lower the tempo of this struggle. The pattern has been set by the military and naval strategists, to be sure. The one factor to ensure peace, long-range peace, in the Far East is support of a Pacific victory that will stick. This support must come from every man and woman in America. It is not enough that the Far Eastern experts or the military or political hierarchy support our war effort. Our people must be made and kept aware of the necessity for the kind of victory that I'm speaking of. so that they will not flag in their determination now that victory seems certain. By lack of support, I mean a preoccupation with the nearer problems. The fight with Japan to the people of America is like a thunderstorm in the distant mountains, but from which an appalling flood could result. Most Americans are as unfamiliar with the Far East as the terrain on the other side of the moon. There, 1 billion hungry people live, and there the white man's burden can never be laid down. There, the entire concept of life is different to ours. People live and die and reproduce so rapidly that the very earth groans under their weight. I have no illusion about complete and lasting peace in that area, but I do feel that the threat of war against these United States can be removed for many years, not by conversation or resolutions, but by total smashing victory. This victory cannot be achieved, as many think, merely by bombing of the Japanese people. The home front, it must be remembered, did not let the German army down in this war. The violent death of the Japanese army is the measure of the kind of a victory that will stick in the years to come. This death is possible in the shortest time if America turns her armies loose on the Japanese archipelago and cuts the heart out of her empire. This can and will be done if the American people are presented fairly with the facts and mobilized anew behind our fighting forces. Now the Japanese Navy is finished as a major threat to our operations in and around the Japanese islands. We are hemming them in, and they can't come out of their islands. But they can and will fight like a cornered leopard for their existence. Here in the United States, and I've been around in 32 states very recently, we are besieged with another epidemic of wishful thinking. There are so many who will believe anything but the obvious. The delusion that Japan will surrender tomorrow or the next day or the next is sweeping this country. Everywhere one hears, it won't be long now. Well, won't it? Pride in America's achievements blind these peoples to the facts in the Pacific War. They may be still indulging in wishful thinking next summer or the summer after that. If you ask me why won't Japan surrender, the answer could well be, what will she save by surrender? With one breath, we claim she will surrender her cities to save her cities, and in the next we assert very boastingly in all our papers that we have reduced her great cities to ashes and rubble. It is too late for Japan to save much by surrender. And from the Japanese viewpoint, have we ever made it possible for her to surrender? You might say that the Japanese people ought to have something to say about continuing to fight a lost war. Well, the Japanese people are in the grip of a Gestapo that makes Hitlers look like amateurs. The Reservist Association of ex-soldiers, numbering millions, all of them drawing government checks, are in every village and inform on anyone who expresses the slightest dissatisfaction. They are the stool pigeons of the thought control police, and the police are everywhere. In turn, the army controls the police. You might say that the Japanese are licked as of this moment. That is correct. But you are going to have to fight a major war with major effort and major figures, including casualty lists, to prove to them that they are licked. Just remember that they have a philosophy of life that tells them it is better to die than to surrender. You can prove that by Okinawa. We're gloating over the fact that out of 70,000 Japanese, we collected 100 yesterday as prisoners. You might say that we will ultimately destroy them. Yes, but in the process, we can suffer terrible losses. You might say that the industrialists see the handwriting on the wall and will throw their influence toward surrender. They tried to prevent this war, but they were powerless. Industry, too, in Japan, as well as the people, are completely controlled by the military. The industry of Japan has been in the hands of five families, and with the cooperation of the army, this big five ruled expanding industrial Japan and delivered themselves body and soul into the hands of the general staff. In short, the unconditional surrender we are demanding will have to be compelled by force. I want to reiterate that the Japanese army will not surrender to an inference, the inference that it is beaten. Let us look back on the German army after D-Day. Militarily, its plight was so far beyond redemption that it should have laid down its arms. But it fought on for 11 months longer under massive assaults of enemy armies totaling 10 million men. Sometimes, you know, it is useful for us to put ourselves in the other fellow's place. Suppose an enemy had captured Cuba, the equivalent of Okinawa, and was bombing New York, Boston, Pittsburgh, and Washington. Would an American army of 5 million, still intact, surrender? Would any American in this room ask that army to surrender? It cannot be said too strongly that for us to bemuse ourselves with the unwarranted assumption that the Japanese army will dishonor itself by abject surrender before it has met the enemy, for us to do that would mean that we are leaving the course and conduct of the war to wishful thinking. Surely there is no one in this room who would want our armed forces to proceed from now on the assumption that the Japanese army will quit. Are we not all under the solemn obligation to those who have died and who will die for this country? Are we not under solemn obligation to dispense with wishful thinking? And I include the press, and put on the army the armor of a soldier's spirit and keep it on while one American fighter's life is in jeopardy. Now, the pattern of Japanese propaganda for home consumption is already unfolding. Her people and army are being told 24 hours a day that our barbarous bombers have leveled their cities and killed 3 million of their people. Italy and Germany are being held up as horrible examples of what happens to countries that surrender to the Allied nations. Now, we know from experience that when you bomb cities, you destroy the cities. But as far as their populations are concerned, you merely kill and maim some and enrage the survivors. Bombing has not made anyone quit in this war. It didn't make the British or the Germans or the Russians quit. It is quite true that the German could not meet us on equal terms after 3 years of bombing. But we had to beat her eventually on the ground, with Russian armies numbering millions and American and British armies numbering millions more. Air power represented only a fraction of the total mechanized force and firepower which the Allies turned on the Reich. Now, there's no question of our ultimate victory, and I don't want anyone to leave this room and say that I left that question with you. If the military occupation of Japan is our objective, we can accomplish it. The Japanese cannot prevent it. The point to remember is that when we land on Japan, we will still find an army there to oppose us, still a good army. Still willing to fight, just as willing to fight as it was 3.5 years ago when it achieved its tremendous victories. At the risk of being repetitive, I want to point out that Japan remains a formidable enemy. Whipped in the air and on the sea, deprived of Germany's aid, driven back to its inner bastions, it still retains as allies great oceans and great distances. And the bulk of the Japanese armies are intact. It is true that the Japanese soldier is no longer making his sacrificial banzai charges, but he is still dying almost to the last man. The difference is that he is selling himself more dearly and much more efficiently than he was a year or two ago. I cannot go into an analysis of his increased fighting efficiency, as that would involve matters of security. But you would find those comments extremely interesting. But I can say that he has learned much in the past 3.5 years from our superior tactics and techniques. That is why Okinawa has been so much tougher than New Guinea. Japan's Kwantung Army, apart from her home defense army, that Kwantung Army that lives off Asia, has developed some interesting new weapons, and that is another army that can be whipped only by heavy land forces. I've read a number of appraisals of the recent action of the Japanese Diet, but a realistic appraisal of its surrender of all its functions and powers to Premier Kentaro Suzuki can only be that this abdication is not, as some of our commentators have seen it, an indication of weakness. It is rather evidence of a desperate resolve to fight it out, a commitment to national harakiri. It is additional proof that we must prepare ourselves mentally and physically to win our war with Japan the hard way, by killing Japanese soldiers right up to the gates of Tokyo. Thank you. Now, from 30 years' observation of the Japanese character and national psychology, I am thoroughly convinced that of the three Axis partners, Japan will take the toughest beating and be the hardest to kill. Surely Okinawa bears me out when we remember that we had to commit 250,000 men to the job of taking an island half the size of Long Island from some 60 or 70 Japanese, 70,000, and had to accept extremely heavy casualties. From that, we can gain some idea of the huge forces that will be required for the assault on the home islands, which are many times larger, with heavier and far more elaborate defenses, and held by 3 million or more of Japan's finest troops. This morning I was asked if the Japanese would not soon see the logic of surrender. Now, the Japanese mind does not deal in logic as we know it. You've got to remember that our logical Anglo-Saxon mental processes are rooted in 2,000 years of the continuing influence of Greek thought with its clarity, of Roman law with its rigidity. God knows how rigid lawyers can be. And of the Old Testament with its severe moral judgments. That's where we derive our logic. After you have lived in Japan for a while, as some of you have, you are forced to recognize that the absolutes in which our attorneys deal are not an element in the Japanese mind as they are with us. They don't accent the positive or eliminate the negative. They always mess with Mr. In Between. Now, for example, take a law case. I have borrowed from you in this room 20,000 yen. It was borrowed on terms, and I have not returned it according to the agreement. There is no argument about the amount or the terms. You ask the court to compel me to keep the letter of the agreement. An American or a British court would give an absolute, unqualified decision in the case that I return the 20,000 yen, but not so in Japan. You would be awarded 15,000 yen, and the judgment would include 5,000 yen or so to me. This 5,000 yen has a technical legal name called Nami Dakin, or tear money. Now, this solacium dries my tears as the loser. It allows me to pay my attorney's fees, and it saves my face. But logic, God knows, plays no part in it. I'll give you one more example of Japanese logic that I ran into. I was at the dock at Yokohama one 4th of July when a steamer was docking with Sir Harry Lauder and a very distinguished New York politician on board. The Japanese band at the dock was confronted with a problem of protocol. Which to serenade first? Now, the solution was found by playing Just a Wee Dock and Doris and Sweet Rosie O'Grady at one and the same time. Now, Schiller said, against stupidity, even the gods fight in vain. And the sacrificial quality of Japanese battle zeal combines with a certain stupidity that leaves no room for logic. We have come a long way from Pearl Harbor Sunday. We have left the valley of the shadow, and we've moved into the light of victory. But when you fly to the far Pacific, you can see how our path is marked on all its islands. You can see the milestones of the months, and in the myriad white crosses, row on row, you see that we have given countless hostages to death and paid the inevitable, the immutable price of victory. I have seen some of those men die, and I shall always remember their faces as we place them lovingly, reverently in the ground. Our poor power of speech, of tongue or pen here today, can add nothing to what these men have done and given. All that we can hope to do is to follow their example, to show the same selfless courage and determination that they did, the same stubborn strength and power of human will. These men who died had a right to live. We owe it to them and to ourselves. We owe to them a rededication of thought and spirit and energy to the relentless prosecution of the grim tasks ahead of us. We must push on with higher hearts and a long-range faith. None of us is yet released from the immediate and heavy obligations to carry on working, praying, fighting for complete and final victory, for a country where each will have his chance and each his duty. The word duty reminds me of an incident on Singapore a few days before its capture. I had met a colonel of the Argyles, one of the old British spit and polish outfits, old British regiments of the line, shortly before the Japanese attacked on Pearl Harbor on December 8th, and I say spit and polish in tribute to them. And the colonel of that Argyle regiment was a grand soldier. I remember one night some Americans had him to dinner. I was one of them. And we were boasting about some tiger hunting in Italy, in India, or one of the Americans was. And the British colonel finally got fed up with it. And he told the tiger story to end all tiger stories, I think. He said, I went hunting there once, too. And I flushed a tiger so large that you couldn't get him into one of your American boxcars. I was in an open spot, and when he sprang at me, he jumped clean on over me and landed 50 yards beyond. The next day, I thought I would go looking for smaller game, and when I came to the clearing, there was the same big tiger practicing short jumps. Well, that regiment of the Argyles went into action with 1,200 men and 38 officers. And they fought a withdrawal for 400 miles down the Malay Peninsula. And when they crossed the Strait of Johor to the island of Singapore, they had 48 men and one officer left. The next day, a corporal of the Argyles with three men was marching to his post at a vital pipeline, and an officer of a British regiment, which had just landed with reinforcements, met the corporal and said, Corporal, you and your men look exhausted, and you should ask to be relieved. I believe the corporal's reply sums up all that can be said of what we should demand of ourselves in devotion to duty until this job is done. His reply was, "My colonel's orders, sir, are to report at the pipeline, and whether he is alive or dead, he will expect me to be there. So I shall be on my way, sir, with your kind permission. Thank you."